I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Earlier this month, FBI agents descended on the home and offices of powerful Electricians Union leader John Dougherty and on his ally, City Council Majority Leader Bobby Heenan. And last week it emerged that investigators subpoenaed the campaign finance records of Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney as part of that probe. WHYY's Dave Davies has this look at the political impact as Dougherty and Kenney are drawing unwanted scrutiny.
Let's begin with Mayor Kenney, who was off to a strong start in his first year, getting a controversial soda tax passed and new initiatives approved. He's not known to be a target of the investigation. His office wasn't raided, and he hasn't retained a personal attorney, which anybody in serious legal jeopardy would. But the raid on Dougherty, arguably the mayor's strongest supporter, and the Fed's interest in his campaign records does cast a shadow. Is he weakened? One measure is how Kenney's viewed in Harrisburg, where the mayor needs clout.
Well, I think as people hear the news that a Philadelphia labor leader and Philadelphia mayor are under investigation, there's probably a collective shrug from the rest of the state.
That's David Patty, a veteran Harrisburg political consultant. He says if the news doesn't get worse for Kenney, meaning there aren't reports that the feds are zeroing in on him, he'll keep his credibility in the Capitol. In Philadelphia, no one's calling for Kenney's head, but some have noted an unsettling parallel. In 2003, FBI agents brought search warrants and carted boxes out of the office of one of then-Mayor John Street's top fundraisers, Ron White, not unlike the events of 3 weeks ago with Dougherty. Kenney says if anyone thinks this is similar...
I'm sorry they feel that way. That doesn't cast a shadow over the efforts that we're making to decrease poverty in the city, get kids a good education, and get kids a great life. I mean, I'm going to continue to do that every day, and all these other distractions are what they are.
Another place to look for impact is on City Council, where Dougherty holds enormous influence. Council Majority Leader Bobby Heenan is a paid employee of Dougherty's union. Heenan's office was also raided by the FBI. Will other council members try and challenge Heenan's position and the influence of Dougherty and his union? Council members contacted were reluctant to criticize Heenan or Dougherty or say much of anything publicly. They note that federal investigations can take years and may or may not lead to charges. In the meantime, Dougherty will be around and powerful, in part because his union's political committee is the biggest spending PAC in Pennsylvania. Political consultant Maurice Floyd says other politicians under investigation can find it hard to raise money and maintain their clout. For example, when under indictment and awaiting trial, former Philadelphia Congressman Shaka Fatah struggled to raise campaign funds. But Dougherty is different.
He doesn't have to really go out to raise money. You know, Johnny Doc's funding comes from his members, so he's in a different position altogether.
Finally, there's the potential impact on Philadelphia's labor movement. Last year, Dougherty became general manager of the Building Trades Council. Philadelphia AFL-CIO President Pat Iding, who did not back Dougherty for that post, says he's thrown himself into the job, being a tireless ambassador for union labor in the city.
He's promoting to developers that it's a better day to do business here. Now, John has a sense of business. He knows how to sit down and say, you know, what is it you need and what can we do to get him?
There's another side to Dougherty's energy which may not be so positive for the trade's image. In February, he got into a job site confrontation where fists were thrown. Iding says his people aren't so worried about that.
First of all, some people probably look up to him because the guy deserved a smack in the mouth because of what he was saying about John's family. I mean, we got professional football players getting into brawls in clubs where labor's involved. The FBI and those folks are going to take a whole different look at it.
In any case, there's little doubt that the investigation will be a distraction for Dougherty, which could affect his work in labor matters. Maurice Floyd, the Philadelphia consultant, says the political impact on Mayor Kenney and others may be muted for a while because it's August and players are less engaged, and because no one seems to have any idea where this investigation is going.
I mean, it's a pretty big story, but, you know, I mean, there's just really no way of wrapping your hand around this thing. You just sort of just wait and see.
Dave Davies, WHYY News.
1 million kids are arrested in the United States every year, and families who can afford the associated court fees and fines have a reasonable chance of keeping their children out of subsequent legal troubles. A new report out today from the Juvenile Law Center focuses instead on what happens to those kids who can't pay for their freedom. Joining me is Jessica Fireman, author of Debtors, Prison for Kids, The High Cost of Fines and Fees in the Juvenile Justice System. She also serves as Associate Director at Juvenile Law Center. Jessica, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
This is a look at all 50 states. So if roughly 1 million kids are arrested, how many fall into this category of not being able to afford to pay?
We really don't have the data on numbers because states are not tracking how many kids can or can't afford to pay, but we think it's probably hundreds of thousands of kids.
Are these kids not even afforded the same rights as adults in similar situations?
It really depends on the state. In some states, adults have the same problem, a sort of pay-to-play situation or a debtor's prison situation. The difference is kids don't have jobs, typically. They don't have access to the kinds of money that adults at least sometimes have access to. So we're putting kids in a situation that there's no way for them to get out of.
Well, then let's focus on Pennsylvania. I understand some of your work focused very specifically on one county.
Yes, we worked with two criminologists, Alex Picaro and Wesley Jennings, who did in-depth research on recidivism rates in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. And they were looking at what's the consequence to kids of having court costs. And they found that actually having costs imposed increases a kid's chance of reoffending later.
But is it that the court system and judges specifically don't have the latitude to either waive or set up fees over time?
In some cases, the fees are mandatory and the judges have no discretion. In other cases, judges may not realize the harms that the fee structure is imposing on kids.
So what are the harms that the fee structure is imposing?
For kids who can't pay, they may end up with extended probation. They may have to come into court more often. They may be placed in a secure facility, a juvenile jail. They may stay longer in a juvenile jail, and they may even be denied treatment that they need, depending on the state.
Are we talking primarily or exclusively about kids charged with violent crimes?
No, it could be kids charged with any offense. In fact, one of the young people we talked to had a truancy fine. He owed $500 for having skipped school, and he didn't have money. He went to court. He didn't have a lawyer with him, and he just thought, I know I can't pay. I know my mom can't pay, so I'll just tell the judge that I'll do the time. And he spent 3 months in a secure facility. He experienced solitary confinement, really harsh conditions, just because he couldn't pay the fine for skipping school.
Listeners might be reminded of the horrible pay-to-play scandal toward this end in Pennsylvania years back. Is this a variation of that? Is there a financial incentive to keeping kids from an early release?
One of the things we're really concerned about is that the probation system or the court system is relying on kids and families paying into the system for its subsistence. And that's obviously something that we don't want.
Is it an oversimplification to say that by definition, it seems that those with means are more likely to escape these kind of punitive damages and that there's also likely a racial component as well?
Absolutely. So the two problems that we see is just straight out inequality in the system. So it's justice by income. If you have the money to pay off a fee, you're done with probation and you can move on. If you don't have the money, you may stay on probation for months and months and months. If you have the money, you may be able to return into a community placement. If you don't have the money, you might stay locked up in a secure facility that's essentially a jail. The criminologist also looked at racial disparities in the system. What they found is that young people of color in Allegheny County were more likely to owe money than their peers when their cases were closed.
Who in the criminal justice system writ large would you most appreciate this report getting into the hands of?
We would love for policymakers to take a hard look at this and start thinking about their state legislation. We'd also love for judges to think about this in a new way. Judges in a lot of states do have authority to impose a cost or not impose a cost, and they may not have had the information about the unequal consequences or the fact that kids are more likely to offend. So if judges would read this and talk with us, we would be delighted.
Jessica Fireman, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Jessica Fireman is author of the new Juvenile Law Center study entitled debtor's prison for kids, the high cost of fines and fees in the juvenile justice system. She also serves as associate director at Juvenile Law Center, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, lifelong Delaware resident and gubernatorial hopeful Lacey Lafferty remains optimistic while running for the GOP nomination in an historically blue state.
It has nothing to do with your party affiliation, whether you're Republican, Democratic, Independent, or whomever. We're all sick and tired of being sick and tired.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. There's change ahead at the helm in Delaware. A two-term limit spells the end of Democratic incumbent Governor Jack Markell's tenure. U.S. Congressman and former Lieutenant Governor John Carney is running unopposed for the Democratic nomination. Two Republicans are vying to take him on, Lacey Lafferty and Colin Bonini, and in advance of the Delaware primary election just 1 week from Tuesday. Let's hear today from Lacey Lafferty. Lacey, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you allowing me to have this time.
This is your first foray into politics, so before we talk about that, tell us about your varied background, including your time with the Delaware State Police.
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I was politically engaged 25 years ago. I was a Democratic committee boardman for the 40th District in Sussex County, and then I assisted Attorney General Jane Brady with her campaign. That's when I transferred over to the Republican Party, assisting her with her winning campaign. I learned a great deal from that campaign, and I've used that strategy within my own. But in the meantime, before that, I've owned businesses within the state in the last 35 years, agricultural, poultry division, and a trucking division. As I transitioned out of my trucking business, I was engaged in her campaign for attorney general, and when she won, I worked in the attorney general's office for a period of months before I was hired with Delaware State Police.
Having always lived in Delaware, you know the deck is stacked against you to the extent that there are so many more registered Democrats than Republicans. What are your realistic chances of prevailing?
Well, I'm counting on these Democrats that are fed up with the same old, just like we all are. It has nothing to do with your party affiliation, whether you're Republican, Democratic, Independent, or whomever. We're all sick and tired of being sick and tired.
To what extent does your message of a newcomer resonate rather than somebody who has experience, be it Colin Bonini or John Carney?
They're tired of the same old career politicians running for decades and decades and actually not delivering on anything of their promises, campaign promises. And this is where we stand in 2016. People have had enough, and they want to change. And they want people that are like themselves, that have lifelong skills from different areas of careers that can go out here and make the formidable decisions that everybody needs. And foremost is the economy and, you know, education and crime throughout the state. And I have expertise in all three of those areas.
Now, I understand that both you and Colin Bonini do back Donald Trump in his run for president. How do you square some of Donald Trump's more controversial comments with what he's trying to achieve in the end, which is attain the White House?
People are listening to me and what my political platform is, and not so necessarily because I'm supporting the Republican nominee of the Republican Party. And I said that in the very beginning when there were 16 of them. I said I will support whoever wins the Republican nominee. I agree with most of what he says, and to where, yeah, Donald's Donald. He tends to be, as we would say, a bit lippy. And he says things that I'm sure he has that brash way of saying things. I don't think he intentionally wants to hurt people or intentionally wants to say things to hurt people's feelings. But people, when they talk to me, they want to know about me. And this is why I go around to these different events, meetings, festivals, parades, and I've been doing so for 3.5 years. People want to hear what I've got, what my political platform is, what my ideas are. And they really don't compare me to him.
So let's focus on you. Should you prevail September 13th and go on and win the general election November 8th, what are your couple or three top priorities when you get in office?
Well, I can tell you, we need to streamline the Department of Education. Right now, the third of the budget is what it is, and it's extremely too expensive for what we're putting out, the product that we're putting out. So what I wanted to be able to do is to return the schools to the districts and streamline the Department of Education, eliminating a lot of the administrative duties and the six-figure salaries, and taking that money and putting it down into the front lines of education and the teachers, the students, and the classroom level. We have to be able to control the continuity and the behavior within that classroom setting. And I want to be able to install video cameras within those classrooms. So we deal multiple things, and it's going to solve a multiple array of things.
Thank you for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Delaware gubernatorial candidate Lacey Lafferty on NewsWorks Tonight. Tomorrow we'll speak with her rival, Republican gubernatorial candidate Colin Benigni. And you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Looking at the racial makeup of professional sports teams, you might think the leagues are leaders in quelling racism. But following recent incidents, our commentator Solomon Jones sees a different situation.
Racism stands at the intersection of sports and media in America. If that truth has ever been in question, the events of the last week should erase all doubt. First, we learned that a modern-day iteration of the Jim Crow-era radio show Amos and Andy had been revived in Philadelphia. A white radio producer at a Philadelphia sports station spent months calling its most popular show as Dwayne from Swedesboro, a fake black character awash in racial stereotypes. Then on Saturday, Colin Kaepernick, one of the National Football League's few black quarterbacks, sat during the national anthem at a preseason game in San Francisco. "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color," he explained. "To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." Kaepernick was bitterly criticized after taking that stand for blacks like Freddie Gray, who died of a spinal injury he sustained in the back of a police van. Though Baltimore's coroner called Gray's death a homicide, the officers involved escaped conviction. Several received back pay. So yes, Kaepernick has a point made by a black quarterback. Quarterback, you see, is among the most important leadership positions in American sports. In American sports, from the media who cover it to the owners, managers, and coaches who oversee it, has long embraced institutional racism in one form or another. In the 1920s, when pro football was in its infancy, the federal government was segregated, the Ku Klux Klan was growing, and the NAACP was fighting tooth and nail against lynching. Against this backdrop, Fritz Pollard became the first black football coach in the league that would later become the NFL. He went on to play quarterback as well. Despite his achievements, the NFL banned black players in 1933. But the racism in American sports is about more than football. It's about fear. The fear that black athletes would obliterate the artificial dividing lines of race. The fear that black competitors would disprove the core tenets of white supremacy. For every Jack Johnson who fought his way to the heavyweight championship in the 1910s, there were black men who were lynched for even aspiring to such a goal. For every Fritz Pollard who excelled in professional football, there were scores of black players who were banned. After decades of race-based exclusion, firm barriers still remain. That's why only 6 of the 32 projected NFL starting quarterbacks this year are black. The history of racism in American sports is what allows a white producer to demean black people. That same history produces sports reporters who castigate Colin Kaepernick for demanding justice. But if Kaepernick's critics truly believe in the principles of American freedom, principles that have too often been violated in sports culture, perhaps they should stop denigrating him for exercising his right to protest. Perhaps they should stand up and applaud. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. You can find our podcast on iTunes. The city of Philadelphia is committed to cutting the population in its overcrowded jails, and on tomorrow's show, we'll hear about how the city is looking to a computer algorithm to help it reach that goal. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.